From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Again and again, we find inaccurate, false, wrong reports that are, we think, designed to be inflammatory that appear on this network.
That was State Department spokesman Richard Boucher in a press briefing on Tuesday. He was talking about Al Jazeera, the influential news network funded by the Arab Emirate of Qatar that's been harshly panned by the U.S. government. The U.S. claims that Al Jazeera, with its fabrications and bias, is making an already bad situation in Iraq that much worse. And this week, Secretary of State Colin Powell said that relations between America and Qatar were clouded by its coverage of the war. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera claims that its reporters are frequently harassed and arrested by American troops in Iraq. Others charge America with hypocrisy for celebrating press freedom while intimidating Al Jazeera. Robert Tappan is the director of strategic communications for the Coalition Provisional Authority based in Baghdad. He says that Al Jazeera's coverage and that of Dubai-based network Al Arabiya has only worsened in recent weeks. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Why do you think Al Jazeera's coverage has gotten worse over recent weeks?
Well, I think that Al Jazeera benefits in terms of its notoriety and popularity, actually, when it exploits the situation at hand. As you know, over the last 2 weeks, we've had an intensification of military conflict. And at the same time, we also see news organizations such as Al Jazeera, trying to inflame and incite the passions of people where their relatives are perhaps losing their lives or in the midst of military conflict.
So Al Jazeera is just feeding the rumor mill and making an already hot situation hotter, in your view?
In some instances, I think they contribute to that in a great deal.
We should point out that when those four American civilians were brutally murdered and hung off a bridge in Fallujah last month, Al Jazeera was one of the few networks, and this includes American networks, that didn't immediately broadcast the images.
Well, score one for Al Jazeera in terms of responsible journalism.
You're suggesting that stations like Al Jazeera are inflaming the population for ratings. Reporters and journalists from Al Jazeera that we've spoken to say they simply have a different context. They see it from the side of the people who believe they're being occupied by a power that won't let them go.
Well, I would certainly disagree with that viewpoint, and they're certainly entitled. I cannot read into their intentions, but I would make the point that there has been a pattern of misrepresentation that is disturbing, and I think that any journalistic endeavor or enterprise would be not proud of their track record.
What kind of scrutiny is the coalition applying to Al Jazeera? What are you looking for exactly?
Well, we've developed what we call the truth matrix, which is basically an elaborate spreadsheet that catalogs individual instances where these news organizations have either used bias or distortion or misrepresentation in their reporting. The list is rather long, I might add.
Can you give me some examples?
Sure. Just in the last 2 days, Al Arabiya reported that U.S. soldiers were occupying a hospital in Najaf and that we weren't allowing any people to come in. That's a clear and blatant misrepresentation of the situation at hand. We've also been accused by Al Jazeera of targeting reporters. We've also had a number of instances where Al Jazeera has alleged that we use cluster bombs in our military actions. That is blatantly untrue. These misrepresentations are costing American and coalition lives, and we just cannot stand by and let that happen.
U.S. officials have also questioned the speed at which Al Jazeera has broadcast messages from Iraqi militants and kidnappers. Is there a suggestion here that Al Jazeera actually has a relationship with the enemy?
Well, I don't know how I can characterize that other than it's awfully coincidental when some news organizations are Johnny on the spot in so many different instances where personnel and innocent civilians have been killed or injured.
We spoke to a reporter who spoke to an Arab reporter who, yes, got calls from insurgents about events that had just occurred or that were just about to occur, and they rushed to the scene. It doesn't actually, though, make them collaborators, does it?
If a potential terrorist tips off a news organization that something is about to happen, I think that a responsible reporter or news organization is duty-bound to try to head off any sort of terrorist act that possibly may go their way. Also, too, I think that news reporting organizations should realize that they're being used in the most disgusting way to further political or terrorist ends.
That may be, and that's often the case. But I think that there are a lot of journalists who say that if they begin passing off source information to one side in a war, whether in Salvador or in Northern Ireland, their neutrality and their ability to cover that war would be irreparably harmed. They might as well not be there at all.
I would disagree in the case of terrorism. We're talking about people and sometimes organized entities that are trying to disrupt the very fabric of civilization in a particular area. They should be treated differently than nation-state actors.
Okay. Robert Tappan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Robert Tappan is the Director of Strategic Communications at the Coalition Provisional Authority.
On Friday night's edition of Nightline, Ted Koppel read the names and showed pictures of the hundreds of American men and women who have been killed in combat in Iraq. It was a controversial broadcast. Sinclair Broadcast Group, which, according to CNN, has contributed to the Bush campaign but not to John Kerry's, ordered its 8 stations not to broadcast the episode titled The Fallen. According to Sinclair's online statement, the broadcast seemed to be, quote, motivated by a political agenda designed to undermine the efforts of the United States in Iraq. But Nightline calls the episode a tribute, and executive producer Leroy Sievers, with whom we spoke prior to the broadcast, said that the program has been taking notice of the soldiers' deaths in Iraq all along in a nightly feature called Line of Duty.
Then we realized that what we were saying each night was 2 soldiers were killed in this ambush, 3 Marines were killed by a roadside bomb, and not getting past the numbers. Ted Koppel and I were both embedded with the 3rd ID during the invasion, and we got to know the soldiers as individuals, and we realized that we've all sort of lost that. And it bothered us, and we thought we need to find a way to put the faces back on the people that are over there. So I remember the Life magazine. I was a child during the Vietnam War, and Life magazine ran a spread in 1969 showing the names and faces of all those killed in a given week there. And we thought, well, why don't we do the same thing? So they're not anonymous. I know some people think this is a political statement. The way we're thinking of it was, you know, if you agree with the war or not, these men and women are still over there in our names. They have paid the ultimate price in our names, and I think the least we can do is give them back their names for one night.
Well, I must say, on this program, we noted with sadness the day the names of the dead stopped appearing on the front page of America's newspapers and became the sort of routine business of updating the toll. But since you brought up the question of a political statement, isn't there some sort of implicit editorializing in an exercise like this, a kind of shaking of the American public to see, yes, these are our young men and women who are dying here. Do you understand what is going on? Is none of that in your mind as you prepare for this broadcast?
I mean, I have to admit, I expected some controversy. I've been stunned by the vehemence and the anger. Who could possibly object to honoring the dead by saying this is who they were? I mean, 2 weeks ago, President Bush in his press conference said it's important to acknowledge the sacrifices that these men and women have made. That's what we're trying to do. You know, when is the right time? People said, well, why don't you wait till Memorial Day, or why don't you wait till Veterans Day? Why do you have to wait? There are men and women dying every day. The families live with it every day. This nation faces it every day. Is it only okay 2 days a year to recognize what they've gone through? That's editorializing. We don't want to hear about it except on those 2 days set aside.
I'm surprised, actually, that you're surprised that people are looking at this with raised eyebrows, because the way that this is being done, not in Life magazine, but in a news and public affairs program, does smack of, I don't know, editorializing. Are you saying it didn't occur to you that this would happen?
Of course it occurred to me, but when would be the right time then? Tell me when it's not, quote, editorializing. 5 years from now, 50 years from now?
Well, let's just say Memorial Day, for example.
And so it's only on Memorial Day. I mean, to me, doing them like on Memorial Day is a little bit like people who go to church on Christmas and Easter. You know, on Memorial Day, people are going to picnics. Like, oh, yeah, that's right. It's about the soldiers. Okay, thanks. I'll have my hamburger well done.
Mm-hmm. There was one complaint in the Washington Post about Friday's broadcast, and that is that it's occurring during a sweeps period. This writer, Lisa DeMoraes, was appalled that Nightline would be cynical enough to come up with a sweeps blockbuster on the bodies of the war dead.
My only defense on that is I was too stupid to, and I'm not comfortable making this, but I was too stupid to realize that sweeps were starting. I know that any number of writers don't believe that and have said so. It never occurred to me that May sweeps would begin on a Thursday in April. People that know Nightline, that know Ted, that know me, know that we don't worry about that a lot. We went into this not expecting this to be a huge ratings winner. I expect people to watch maybe 30 seconds or a minute. I have no idea how people are going to respond, but I have a more visceral response as well. Ted has covered 13 wars. I've covered 14. I've seen men die in combat. And for anyone in particular, someone who has never seen that and who goes to their office and goes home to their nice home every night, to accuse us of manipulating the deaths of men and women in combat, and remember, we were over there in that war, is so offensive that I don't know how to respond in any other manner.
The Sinclair group of stations has apparently, I'm speaking to you on a Thursday, ordered its ABC affiliates not to run this episode of Nightline. They said it was contrary to the public interest. Why does Sinclair object?
I'll be honest with you, that's out of my world. I'm not trying to dodge the question. It's just sort of, you know, the affiliates and their decisions is not, is luckily not one of the things I have to deal with.
Now that the furor has swirled around this broadcast, do you wish that you had done it differently, or are you happy, actually, that this tempest has called attention to the very names and faces whose attention you were trying to draw the American public to begin with?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not, you know, particularly happy that the tempest, because I think, you know, I mean, one of the things that the controversy has shown, at least to me, is just how polarized and how angry this country is. And my great fear is that lost in all of that is what we were trying to do, which is to acknowledge the sacrifice of more than 700 American men and women. I hope that isn't lost. I hope that wasn't lost. The controversy is a controversy, and we have no control over that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Leroy Sievers is the executive producer of Nightline, which on Friday broadcast names and faces of the Iraq War dead.
Coming up, an apology from the press and the man who keeps and periodically releases the secrets.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There's been a lot of talk of apologies these days. Richard Clark started the ball rolling with his mea culpa to the American people for intelligence failures that led to the tragedy of 9/11. At the president's recent primetime press conference, the press corps took turns trying to pry an I'm sorry out of the commander-in-chief, both for 9/11 and for poorly planning the Iraq War.
Richard Clark offered an unequivocal apology to the American people for failing them prior to 9/11. Do you believe the American people deserve a similar apology from you, and would you be prepared to give them one?
It is a pity, declared The Nation magazine last week, that the major news media have not convened a commission of inquiry to examine their own mistakes and derelictions. Recently, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius wrote about his own performance with some regret. David, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Bob.
Your column on Tuesday was titled Red Flags and Regrets. An apology? What do you have to apologize for?
Well, I don't know if it's an apology. It certainly is an attempt on my part to talk honestly about what I think I got wrong in looking at 9/11, looking at Al-Qaeda before 9/11, and in thinking about Iraq and what post-war Iraq would be like. And, you know, I just am struck by things that I wish I'd thought in more detail about. And since we're always demanding that kind of accounting and accountability from the people we write about, it seemed to me it was appropriate to focus a little bit of it on my own profession.
I read a lot of newspapers in the lead-up to the war, and every possible scenario for what could go wrong was in various places well laid out. And while there's been a lot of criticism of the American media for participating in the drumbeat to war, nobody can say that all of the downside was not covered or even predicted. Didn't you read those stories?
I read the stories. I wrote some of them myself. I mean, I talked before the war began about the likelihood that Iraqis would hate the occupation and that we should be ready for that. I don't think that's the point. I mean, I think that we can go back and find that all the things that we should have noted were there. The point is that they weren't there in a way that was powerful enough to really force a national debate about this issue.
You made a reference in your column to the coverage of the original World Trade Center bombing in 93, which characterized al-Qaeda at that time as a sort of gang who couldn't shoot straight and kind of rolled its eyes at the government's notion that this was a very dangerous organization that could eventually come back to haunt the West.
I think our skepticism often was focused on the government. You know, were they hyping the threat of al-Qaeda? Were prosecutors overstating the evidence that they had about the bombing in 93, about the embassy bombings in 98? I think that all that healthy press skepticism tended to lean in that direction, and we just didn't see what was in front of our noses just the way it was in front of that of President Bush, of the administration. With Iraq, I think the issue is obviously different. Were we too accepting of the evidence that they put out? As I say in this column, at the time I believed that it was morally and in every sense the right thing to go to war to remove Saddam Hussein as leader of Iraq. I haven't changed that view. I don't regret it. I don't apologize for it. I still hold it. What I do regret is that I and my profession as a whole didn't look more carefully at what would happen afterwards and didn't push the government, help citizens push the government to make that more of an issue than it was.
You say in your column that the media were victims of their own professionalism. What are you talking about there?
Well, you know, I think we have rules of our game. You know, one of them is that we don't make the news, we just report the news, that tend to make it hard for us to tee up an issue, to do reporting about an issue without a news peg. In other words, if Senator so-and-so hasn't criticized post-war planning for Iraq, then it's hard for a reporter to write a story about that because he says, well, you know, I can't make the news on this. I have to wait for somebody to make a statement, and then I'll report on the statement. And I think that's a professional rule that we really ought to examine. Another part of what I was trying to say is that I think professionally we tried to get ready to cover a war that we knew was coming. You know, we could pretend that there was a debate, but we knew the president intended to go to war. We wrote that in the paper often. And I think that we spent those last 3 months before the war started working very hard to make arrangements to get embedded, to cover the war, to get our reporters and other people trained in the use of chemical weapons gear, et cetera. And there's a question, should part of that time have been used to be more aggressive in writing about the issues that would be involved in the war, not getting ready to cover it.
What will you personally do differently in the future?
I think for myself, I want to make sure that when I write about issues that involve the country going to war, that I've been as skeptical as I can about some of the issues that could lie around the corner that are not immediately visible. And I suspect that that's shared widely in the profession. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's feeling that.
Well, David Ignatius, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Ignatius is a columnist for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from his home in Paris.
Washington is a place where jobs change hands every day and most attract no notice. But one resignation is generating considerable buzz, that of National Archivist John Carlin. That may seem a little obscure, but the National Archivist has the power to determine how much of American history is written. The law requires the president to explain why the head of the National Archives is being replaced, but he's kept mum, and so has Carlin, a Clinton appointee and former Kansas governor. In his place, President Bush will nominate Allen Weinstein, a Democrat who has been denounced by many of his academic peers. One of them is John Wiener, a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine and a contributing editor of The Nation magazine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a little background on the role of the National Archivist. What exactly is this person responsible for?
The National Archives is a huge operation, a budget of $300 million, and they deal with a lot of controversial documents and whether to release them, including the Watergate tapes, the records of the Kennedy assassination, all the presidential papers. In part, these, of course, are governed by executive orders on classification, but the archivist has a lot to say about what gets released to whom and when.
Well, what about the laws that specify what is public and what is confidential?
Well, every president is empowered to issue his own executive order on declassification, and some are more in favor of openness, some are more in favor of secrecy.
Some administrations are more open than others. I guess this administration is decidedly less.
This president has tried to undercut the Presidential Records Act, which says that the records of presidents should become available to the public 12 years after they are recorded. It's interesting that his own father's papers would become eligible for release under this Presidential Records Act next January. This president has issued an order that kind of undermines and makes that whole thing irrelevant.
Is it true that under the Bush order, even a president who would like his records to be released can't have them released if the current president doesn't want them to?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing.
Now, the National Archivist is one of those government positions that isn't supposed to be political. It has a 10-year term that isn't linked to changes at the White House, or at least isn't supposed to be. But in recent weeks, there's some concern on the part of the archivist community that something fishy is going on here.
Yeah, there's almost two dozen organizations of historians and archivists that have expressed concern about the nomination of Allen Weinstein and the way it has come about. Carlin was not planning to retire until July 2005. He'd always said he intended to serve for 10 years. Carlin has also refused to comment in response to questions of whether the White House pressured him to withdraw. So I conclude the White House did pressure him to resign.
So then who is Allen Weinstein, and why are the historians and archivists upset about his appointment?
Allen Weinstein is a historian of espionage who's closely connected with Republicans in Congress. He founded an organization called the Center for Democracy. Henry Kissinger is on the board. His own record of releasing documents that he's worked with in his research on Soviet espionage is, frankly, a poor one. He has concealed his own research materials, which violates the ethics of the Society of American Archivists, and refused to make interview tapes available at an archive, which is what's required by the American Historical Association. So there's concern that a man who has a poor record on access to documents should not be in charge of access to documents for the whole country.
His decision not to release the documents related to espionage, the Soviet documents that he had exclusive access to, wasn't that principally a commercial one?
Well, Weinstein and his publisher, Random House, made a deal in the early 90s to pay a large amount of money, I've heard $100,000, to a group of former KGB agents for exclusive access to the KGB archives. That means Weinstein and his publisher paid an archive not to release these documents to anyone else. That's an ethical violation. Now, it's understandable that a commercial publisher would want to make a profit off of exclusive information, but we would like the archivist of the United States to be held to a higher standard.
And so how do you think the process should proceed? You think that Bush should cycle back? That's not going to happen. And talk to historians and archivists? What do you think is the best case scenario here?
There will be Senate confirmation hearings, and any one senator can put a hold on a presidential nomination, which makes it much harder to get it through the Senate. I think there are enough concerns about Weinstein to justify holding up that nomination, and then it'll be postponed because of the election season.
John Wiener, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
John Wiener is a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine and a contributing editor of The Nation magazine.
Satellite
satellite radio is a different animal because it is not over the air. The rules that govern traditional broadcasts don't apply. But content on satellite radio isn't entirely immune from federal regulation. In fact, the very founding of satellite radio, a mere 7 years ago, depended on the promise that it would not air local content. But last month, XM Radio started offering local traffic updates and weather reports. XM contends it's not violating its license because the local content is being offered nationally. For instance, listeners in Seattle can tune into the channel for traffic in Philadelphia. But the National Association of Broadcasters, trying to protect the turf of its member broadcast stations, doesn't see it that way. And this month it formally complained to the FCC. Its beef, says former FCC chief economist Thomas Hazlett, is that XM and Sirius Radio pose a mortal threat to local programming.
The irony now is that to protect local programming, we in fact outlaw local programming by satellite radio. And the question that now comes to us is what constitutes national programming, what constitutes local programming?
Well, it's a question for King Solomon. In your judgment, is this programming national or is it local?
In terms of content, the programming is local. In terms of transmission technology or distribution, it is national. The implications are very large here, and I think that the FCC is going to want to rely on regulation of the transmission technology and stay away from content regulation. That's certainly what the satellite radio operators are hoping.
Let's talk about the NAB for a moment, the National Association of Broadcasters. They're making a number of arguments, mostly about localism and about how the media conglomerates, in this case Sirius and XM, are a threat to local radio all over the country and so forth. Isn't it on the verge of being hilarious that the very organization that has so supported Clear Channel and other omnivorous media conglomerates is suddenly championing the rights and needs of local radio audiences?
Many of these arguments do belong on the Comedy Channel, which I believe is available on satellite radio. You know, as an old member of the Federal Communications staff said years ago, and looking at all the various arguments, he said, boy, with all this talk about the public interest, there must be a lot of money at stake somewhere. But to define localism only in terms of geography is really to deny what the technology allows us to serve in terms of consumer tastes and preferences. That is to say, there are a lot of types of programming out there, whether they be in the music fields or the informational market, where on satellite you really do get a choice of perspectives. This kind of diversity really does allow different communities of interest to have their favorite channels, their favorite shows, their favorite content. Localism does not have much to do with geography anymore.
I remember in the mid to late 60s, with cable television really in its infancy, that the NAB and maybe others in a coalition were telling people to save free TV and sign petitions and to make sure that our free TV signals would be protected by the government, all for fear of this burgeoning cable colossus. Well, 40 years later, it looks like it didn't do any good. There's something more than 75% penetration of cable television in this country. Is this all inevitable? Is satellite radio inevitably going to win this battle?
Who knows? At this point, satellite radio is struggling for financial viability. So I think it's too early to say game over, satellite wins. Right now, really, all the chips are on the side of the table where the local radio stations are sitting. But in some ways, both satellite radio and cable satellite TV have been reactions to regulatory decisions to offer relatively few free over-the-air broadcasting alternatives. There have been choices made to explicitly limit the number of local competitors, both in TV and radio. In the early television market, the regulators killed off a fledgling fourth network, the Dumont Network, simply by issuing too few licenses that were financially viable for operations in the early TV market. In the radio markets now, you find that the regulators haven't learned all that much over the past 40 years. Rather than backing up and saying, as regulators, what are the real public goods we can provide, limiting interference, allowing an orderly marketplace to proceed and offer these various choices to customers at reasonable prices. Instead of doing that, they become very much aligned with the markets that exist and almost implacably become foes of emerging technologies or emerging markets which would challenge those existing structures.
Defenders of the status quo, in other words.
Exactly. And even the chairman of the FCC have commented that FCC in some ways is properly interpreted as forever captured by corporations.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tom Hazlett is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a former chief economist at the FCC.
Coming up, a somewhat compressed history of American media from the revolution to 5 minutes ago.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Paul Starr's new book, The Creation of the Media, begins when America is merely a series of colonies along the eastern seaboard and ends with the nation's entry into World War II in December of 1941. So much has changed since 1941 that this book does not directly address, and yet it has managed to overturn or at least modify every assumption I've made over the years about how the American media arrived in this form at this point in history, April 2004. Starr says the American Revolution united the patriots and the printers, hobbled by taxes, in a way that elevated the importance of freedom of the press.
We were the first country in the world to embody the principle of freedom of the press in our organic law, in our Constitution. It wasn't just that we guaranteed the press the freedom from government intervention. The government actually took positive steps to promote a free press by subsidizing newspapers, by creating a system of free exchange among newspapers. And you have to see this in contrast to what existed in Europe at the time, where in Britain and France and other countries, there wasn't only censorship, there were very heavy taxes levied upon the press. And so instead of taxing the press, we subsidized the press. We had more newspapers. By the time Alexis de Tocqueville came to America, he said Americans go into the wilderness with their axes, their Bibles, and their newspapers.
And your book's underlying message is that it was never mainly about the technology, and it wasn't even mainly about the marketplace, although they both played huge roles. It was mainly about politics.
Yes, I think the early considerations that dominated policy were, first of all, the fear of the disintegration of the republic. How could we hold this country together? And so there were what you might call today nation-building purposes. But it wasn't just any kind of nation that the founders were concerned to build. They were concerned to build a republic. This was a system that subsidized the distribution of political news.
And it's very interesting because, as you say, it was a fragile nation, one spread out over a vast territory, and yet the politicians were willing to put up with a great deal more rancor and vilification in the newspapers they essentially subsidized than is acceptable today.
Well, they weren't entirely happy about this. Washington was attacked, John Adams, and of course, in the late 1790s, under President Adams, Congress passed a measure to try to control criticism, the Sedition Act. But the failure of the Sedition Act really set a very important precedent that, in practice, American politics wasn't going to accept that kind of control.
How did you figure out that the interview was invented by American journalists in 1860?
Well, when important people wanted to have their words in the press before the 1860s, those words appeared in the form of a speech or in the form of an essay. They didn't allow themselves to be put on the spot, ask questions that were, perhaps going to make them blurt out something they didn't want to say. And this was not done in European newspapers. So it was only in the mid-1800s that this practice began in America, and it has a certain egalitarian aspect to it. It puts the reporter more on the level of the person that's being interviewed.
Now, in your book, over and over again, you demonstrate that contrary to what I think is the popular opinion today, it wasn't the technology that pushed forward how we have our national conversation, that the ground was already tilled for that kind of communication before the technology came along.
Well, what I suggest in this book is that when new technologies come along, they provoke a political question. How is this new medium going to be handled? Is it going to be private? Is it going to be public? Is it going to be a military technology? What will be the basic purposes that it serves? And so Europe and America often dealt with the same technology in very different ways. When the electric telegraph first appeared, the Europeans treated it as a military technology. We treated it as a commercial technology. The telephone, same thing. There was a period in the 1890s, early 1900s, when there were hundreds of little mutual telephone companies, independent telephone cooperatives that were established, and telephones spread much more widely, much faster in America than elsewhere.
Why don't you give the example of how the telephone developed here as opposed to the Soviet Union?
After the Soviet Revolution, there was a choice about what kind of investment to make in communications technology, and the Soviets could have invested more in telephones. They didn't. They chose another new technology, the loudspeaker.
So everybody knew what everyone was saying and everyone heard the same thing.
Well, yes, it's a means of projecting the authority of the state.
How about distinguishing between the development of, say, the telephone and the telegraph on our shores?
The telegraph actually illustrates the American dilemma, the problems that we've run into through our history in communications. Because initially, we had a highly competitive telegraph industry with dozens of different firms. But it took only about 20 years for the industry to fall under the control of the Western Union Company, which was actually the first national monopoly of any kind in the United States. And we were totally unprepared for it. We had no antitrust law. We had no principle to deal with this new phenomenon of concentrated private power. And the monopoly of Western Union was especially dangerous because Western Union had a partnership with the Associated Press, which was controlled by a small number of newspapers.
And was America's first monopoly news service.
Right. And so together, they monopolized the distribution of national news. And they were in a position, really, to alter the understanding that Americans had of what was happening politically. And I think in the case of the 1876 election, I try to show that that monopoly helped throw the election in one direction rather than another.
So the development of the telegraph could be seen as an early object lesson in the perils of media consolidation.
Absolutely. In the late 19th, early 20th century, we saw the emergence of antitrust law, and that did help to limit the amount of concentrated control. And then when radio developed, at first there was a great profusion of different radio stations around the country, but relatively quickly again by the late 1920s, NBC and CBS had come to dominate radio. And then during the late 1930s, the New Deal began to question whether this concentrated power was such a good thing. And that resulted in the breakup of NBC, so resulted in the spinning off of ABC, and to limits on the ownership of radio stations. And of course, that brings us down to issues that are still very contemporary with us.
So, having traced the complicated path of American media up to 1941, how would you rate the balance of power between business and government and the individual today? Has it fallen out of equilibrium?
Well, I think the worries that Western Union provoked in the 19th century, the worries that the early radio networks provoked during the 1930s are worth recalling, partly because we face those same issues today. And one of the things that I think is so valuable about the American tradition, here going back to the founding of our country, was a preference for a more decentralized system of communication that provided a tremendous amount of opportunity for new voices to be heard.
And what happened at various points in American history when various technologies got locked up by monopolies?
Well, one of the things I think that's good about the American pattern is that we generally haven't let the company or companies that dominate a prior technology from also controlling a new technology. So if you think about it, the post office didn't get control of the telegraph as happened in Europe. And then Western Union didn't get control of the telephone. And then Bell Telephone didn't get control of broadcasting. So we had competition across the different means of communication. Now, today, one of the things, again, that's worrying is that, of course, the media conglomerates span different media. We don't have that degree of separation, which I think was a very healthy influence in the past.
Paul Starr, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Starr is the author of The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications.
Now, let's leap ahead 60 years or so. In January, music industry executives received heartening news when the Pew Internet and American Life Project reported that illegal music file sharing was down 50%. But the celebration was premature. The first Recording Industry Association of America lawsuits against individual file sharers did frighten off the lighter users from using peer-to-peer networks, but the core users are still sharing. Meanwhile, by the end of 2003, 13% of U.S. households had at least one portable MP3 player, up sixfold from 2001, according to the Consumer Electronics Association. OTM's Ben Walker has looked into a brand new, one might say futuristic, use of MP3s in the Internet, and technically, it's not illegal. Yet.
This song makes me feel as though I'm living in some kind of crazy post-apocalyptic world. One, perhaps, where robots are our masters. But in a good way, you know?
There's tons of blaring trumpets and trombones, tinkly cymbal, and occasional little guitar riffs. It might get a little repetitive, but I love the little horn trills and then the guitar echoing it. Maybe I'm just weird.
This song is like a really good kiss, like a broken jukebox kiss, like a kiss that sends you hurtling back past all the bittersweet moments of life. Each of them sparking into dust.
That's a simulation of what an MP3 blog sounds like. It sounds, as you undoubtedly noticed, a lot like radio, which is why I like to call these new kids on the internet block the MP3Js. Only on the web, they don't talk. They just write about music you can listen to as you read. It's an amazing yet simple concept.
What I'm doing is every day I post one or two MP3s, and I write a bit of commentary about it.
Matthew Perpetua runs Fluxblog, probably the most popular MP3 blog on the internet. Matthew's often referred to as the granddaddy of the MP3Js, a moniker the 24-year-old art school graduate is quick to shake off every time I bring it up. Fluxblog, Matthew insists, is of modest origins, a college with no campus radio station.
I didn't have a radio show. So being able to put songs up and have people hear them, it kind of filled that kind of void that I had. That I guess it's almost kind of like the efforts of a very frustrated person who never got to do college radio.
Like all great college DJs, Matthew has a quirky sense of humor and has passion and enthusiasm for bands you've never heard of. Almost every MP3J I spoke with shares this aesthetic. But because it's the internet, there seems to be no limit to how diverse or obscure the music can get. The MP3J Elaine Chang of the MP3 blog Fruits of Chaos, for example, spins Asian music that seems to come from a subgenre of a subgenre of a subgenre.
I try to promote really obscure artists, really obscure even for like Japan or China, because that's sort of cool to see, you know, what's the indie scene over there opposed to the indie scene over here.
When you're posting the music you're talking about, the audience can have a better sense of what it is you're getting at and can begin to maybe hear the same things you hear and get some of the enjoyment that you're getting.
Sean Michaels, a Canadian who runs an MP3 blog called Said the Gramophone. Before Sean started MP3J-ing, he wrote music reviews for a variety of websites, the kind of writing about music you find in magazines and newspapers, top 10 lists, reviews. But Sean found this experience frustrating because he felt it wasn't taking advantage of what the internet had to offer.
I was getting a little bit tired of the format limitations, where you say, this music sounds like this, you'll like it if you like this, buy it or don't buy it. And so I decided to start posting a song and then writing about it. And it was wonderful because suddenly I was suddenly writing the kind of criticism that really engages with the art that it discusses. It's just so much more interesting.
It's unclear how the music business is going to react to this new use of their material. Well, unclear if you don't count the rising number of MP3 file traders who are being sued by the recording industry. But Sean and Matthew feel strongly that their MP3J-ing is something other than piracy, an activity, in fact, deserving of fair use protection. I got Professor Justin Hughes, an intellectual property scholar at the Cardozo Law School, to take a look at a few MP3 blogs. He found it highly doubtful that the courts would buy the argument that the MP3J is transforming the copyrighted works themselves.
Under traditional fair use, it was accepted that you could quote extensively from a work in order to criticize it, to analyze it, to talk about it. What we've got different here is that they're including the whole work. It is a non-transformative copying of the work. It's not like a parody. It's not like a satire.
Professor Hughes did acknowledge that MP3J-ing is an activity that is much less harmful to the industry than anonymous file trading. And it's important to note that no MP3J has yet built a downloadable archive or library. The MP3s are posted only for a limited time, usually a range from a day to a week. Something all MP3Js say is more philosophy than architecture, even though access to large amounts of bandwidth is beyond the average MP3J's reach. The important thing is to stay off the radar of organizations like the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America. But a lot of MP3Js think this is impossible because of something that Matthew did last December.
In December of 2003, I put up a song by the band LCD Sound System called Yeah. That song just blew up. Everybody loved it. It started being posted on internet message boards. Several blogs were linking to it. Almost everybody who heard it just got extremely enthusiastic about it. And that was the point where it really just,
exploded. And today, still coasting on its MP3J-generated buzz, the song is making its way up the charts of hip college radio stations around the country, a feat record companies can spend thousands and thousands of dollars to achieve. But it's more than a new hit song. In breaking Yeah, Matthew inadvertently broke the MP3 blog as well.
People, discovered the site through that song. People were excited about that song, and then I guess people, looked around and they saw something that they go, oh, you know what, I can do that.
And the trend continues, with four or five new MP3 blogs cropping up every week now, which means it's only a matter of time before the next big fight over copyright and fair use on the internet. For On the Media, I'm Benjamin Walker.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Rob Christensen and Jennifer Munson are engineers. We had help from Derek John, our webmaster, is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.